Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Aquarium. I'm Jerry Schubel, president of the Aquarium. It's good to have all of you here. I want to acknowledge our sponsor, Gazette Newspapers, that makes this lecture series possible. I request that you turn off your cell phones or put them on vibrate, and I'm going to do the same thing during the evening and try to refrain from texting until this lecture is over. Tonight, it's a great pleasure to have John Williams with us. He's going to discuss the potential for cancer-fighting pharmaceuticals from marine animals. John is an associate professor of molecular medicine, director of the X-ray crystallography core facility, and co-director of drug discovery and structural biology core at the City of Hope, based in Duarte, California. He previously held positions at the Kimmel Cancer Center in Philadelphia and Jefferson University in New York. Before that, he was an associate research scientist at Columbia University, and he got his real start in an aquarium at the Osborne Marine Sciences Lab at the New York Aquarium in Brooklyn. He grew up in Southern California, and then he went off to the University of California, Santa Cruz for his bachelor's degree, and then went to the East Coast for a master's and PhD in chemistry from Columbia University. He completed postdoctoral fellowships at the European Molecular Biology Lab in Heidelberg, Germany, the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, and the Leukemia Society of America and Columbia University. Distinguished scholar, researcher, and he leads this partnership that the Aquarium has with the City of Hope, and he's going to tell you all about that partnership and why the ocean is so important as a source of potential cures for many human diseases. John?
Let's see. You get this coming in? All right, well, thank you very much for the very kind introduction. So you go back. There we go. It's a great pleasure to be here and to be able to tell you something. And what I want to do is actually give you a completely different reason for conserving the oceans. We like to think that these are important to conserve and they're beautiful animals, and we want to make sure that they're here for our children and we can see beautiful fish. But I think there's something that's even more germane and much more immediate to each one of us. And those are the medicines that we can potentially get from the oceans. And this is part of the sponsor, the project that the Aquarium Pacific and City Hope is trying to bring up. We want to bring the full force of the aquarium and all the exploration and all of its conservation work to the City of Hope, where we are making cancer drugs and trying to save lives. And we need quite a few more of these. So what to think about all of this? Cancer is a killer. It's the number two cause of death in America. It causes more death than the next five diseases that we know of, more than diabetes, more than stroke, more than Alzheimer's, more than car accidents and other kinds of accidents. It's just right below cardiovascular disease, heart diseases, but very soon we'll actually pass those. And so very soon, cancer will be the number one killer of people in the United States. This year alone, 1.6 million people will be diagnosed with cancer. This is a problem that's going to affect every single person in this room. We expect one in two men in their lifetime to come down with cancer. We expect one in three women to have cancer in their lifetime. We split up the room, one half and one half. Somebody will have cancer. So it's immediate and it's something that we need to take care of now. So why is cancer so difficult? Everybody's asking, where's this cure? What's going on and why is it so hard, right? And cancer is a much different kind of disease than some of the other things that we think of, say, influenza. Influenza is caused by a virus, and it manifests itself, and it's always the same kind of a virus. There may be some variants, but it's a virus. It's different. Cancer is difficult because it's just kind of everything that can go wrong, right? And this kind of comes from this Tolstoy quote, "All happy families are alike. All unhappy families are unhappy in their own special way." There's one way to be healthy. There's many ways of being unhealthy, and therefore it's many ways of having cancer. And if we put this by numbers, okay, this is actually extraordinarily remarkable. Your genome has about 3 billion base pairs. That's the DNA. Each base pair is going to get paired up with three, and that's what encodes all the information that allows a person to develop and to be a human. It tells everything about a heart, tells a cell how to take care of different signals. You have 3 billion base pairs, and that's in every single cell. The average body has 37.5 trillion cells. It's a lot of cells. The average lifespan of any cell in the given body is about 7 to 10 years. So after 70 years, you've made about 1 × 10²³ base pairs, okay? That's a lot. That's 23 zeros after that one, okay? And these have to be faithfully transcribed. Every time a cell divides, you have to have perfect transmission of this. You can't have one mistake now and then. You can't have 1% mistakes. You can't have 0.01% mistakes. You can't have a lot of mistakes, okay? But you do make mistakes. That's part of evolution itself. Most of these mutations that will happen actually probably won't do very much to you. They may be in some non-coding region. They may be a simple mutation that doesn't actually change the readout at all. A lot of these mutations will just simply be repaired. Your body has made all the machinery to go and fix these mistakes that can actually happen in a cell. Some of them are so detrimental that the cell just dies. It can't function, it just goes away. So we don't have to worry about those. Occasionally, one of these will combine with maybe one or two more, and it'll actually give an advantage to the cell. And when it gives an advantage, particularly a growth advantage, this becomes cancer. Combine that with everything else that can possibly go wrong. Too much sun, too many chemicals, smoking, unhealthy diets, being obese. You can see why cancer can come up and why it's so prevalent in itself. And this stuff is complicated. It's not that we're sitting back there as cancer biologists and cancer people saying, we can actually come up with a drug tomorrow. In every given cell, there's multiple processes going on. And do I have a pointer? I do, sorry. In multiple proteins are being built, and so you can almost think of this as a CPU, some processes in each one of these yellow boxes, and within these yellow boxes are all these different things that have to go on. And then you also have metabolism. You have to feed the cell. You have to make the materials. You have to make ATP, ADP. You have to make NADHP. You have to make lipids. All of these processes are going on in every single cell. Okay? It's actually even more than that. That's just a cell, right? Inside this cell are all of these processes, but these cells actually form together and they make a tissue. They can make a liver, a heart, an organ like a pancreas, and all of those are there. And all of those are made of the same parts. So if we want to go and try to tackle a cancer on one of these little processes here, it's not that we're just going to get these tumor cells. Most likely, we're also going to antagonize or hit other tissues. And that's what we call side effects. Those are the nasty side effects of chemotherapy that we're so familiar with, and unfortunately, some of the things that we can't avoid. On top of this, a lot of these proteins that are made by your genome actually share some of the similar components. You need ATP. ATP is the fuel of the cell. That's what drives cellular respiration. That's what allows cells to move and allow cells to communicate and do stuff. But a lot of the proteins, particularly these proteins called kinases, actually all bind to ATP. And the best way to turn off a kinase is go right after that ATP site. If we can make a drug to go in that ATP site, then we can stop the kinase. But if they all look alike, we're going to hit every single one of those kinases. So we actually have to get to specificity, and that specificity isn't so easy to get to either. So, you know, it's a little bit like IKEA, right? Everybody gets frustrated by going to IKEA. And so you can go to IKEA and you can go and spend a good amount of the time looking at a bunch of stuff that you know when you get home is not going to be so much fun to build. They're going to give you some kind of a strange screwdriver. They're going to give you a bunch of other bolts. And all you really want to do is build this cabinet, right? And you may be unfortunate. Maybe they forgot to give you this one dowel there. And so you can't actually build your cabinet or your bookshelf, right? That's okay. But if you actually have to make a whole living room of all these furnitures and you have a defective dowel, or you've taken that dowel out of the equation, you're not going to have a very nice looking living room, right? That's kind of a similar thing that we're trying to do. We're trying to turn off one of these things and not affect every single thing else inside the body. Okay, so as dire as the picture as I painted, we do have clues. We do have some thoughts about what we can do to cure cancer. We know that certain things have to happen for cancer to be successful. We know, for instance, that when a cancer cell gets going, it needs to evade the immune system. Your immune system is very, very powerful. It knows how to take care of rogue cells and kind of put them down. A successful cancer cell will tell the immune system, don't bother me, leave me alone. It's going to send out special signals, and we kind of have an idea what those signals are. We know that DNA damage is one of these things. If you have a lot of stress, that this could be part of cancer. Tissue invasion, metabolic stress, oxidative stress. If you're smoking too much, this is part of the cancer phenotype. So we have these clues, and we kind of have some ideas about how to go after these clues. For the most part, the way that we cure cancer is kind of burn, poison, or cut. That's the three options you have when you go after cancer. And so these two work very well. When you have a localized mass, you can go in there and you can pull the whole thing out, and hopefully you don't leave any residual cells in there. Invariably you do. But you get rid of the bulk of it, and that gives your body a little bit better chance of going after the cancer. Radiation, you just burn it out. You're taking a lot of very high-powered x-rays, and you're essentially burning that tumor. And finally, we have these chemotherapeutic drugs. And these chemotherapeutic drugs go after special processes that cancer is using. But really, what we're concerned about with cancer isn't the local mass, the initial tumor itself. We worry about the metastatic disease. We're worried about when it spreads. Because when it spreads, it's all over. And when it's all over, you can't go in and individually burn them out, and you can't individually cut them out. And if that's the case, we really have to rely upon medicines. We need to find small molecules. We need to find biologics. We need to find ways of enhancing the immune system to go after these cancer cells themselves. So how do we find these drugs? I mean, this is kind of a great mystery, I think, to most people in America. How do we actually find drugs? Well, something happened in the 1980s. We've actually went to a targeted therapies. We started to try to develop more specific molecules. Before that, it was just old fashioned, right? How do we find aspirin? Well, I don't know who had the idea, but if we actually sucked on some bark from a birch tree, we actually found aspirin, okay? We had tested on animals. The best way is you go out there, you get your coral, you squeeze it in a bucket with some goldfish, and the goldfish die, you got something that's cytotoxic. If it's cytotoxic, then maybe we can tune that down so that it would be therapeutic. Really, the difference between a toxin and a drug is dose. Okay? That's how we used to do it. We thought in the 80s we could get a lot smarter. We thought that maybe what we could do is we can find single molecules, single proteins that were actually responsible for cancer. P53, KRAS, Src kinase, FAK kinase. And if we could do that, if we could find one of these mutations in those genes, maybe it allowed those products, those proteins, to work a little bit better. So if it worked better, then we should target those and we can turn them off. Alternatively, we may actually find one that makes it non-functional. So a tumor suppressor keeps a cell from growing too fast. And if you make it non-functional, then the cell starts growing too fast. So then maybe what we would do is we'd look for pathways above that tumor suppressor or a molecular pathway below that tumor suppressor. All of this kind of goes under the guise of targeted-based drug discovery. Essentially, what we become is molecular locksmiths. The sole idea here of rational drug design and targeted therapies is that we could actually find the key that would just go into the one protein that was responsible for causing the cancer. Okay? And how did we do that? We started developing X-ray crystallography, which is something we use in my lab. We started screening thousands and thousands of drugs. And if we got lucky, we could actually start building those drugs. And so this is basically what we do at the City of Hope. We call this our therapeutic pipeline. We go and find one of those proteins that we know causes cancer. We validate it. We show in other organisms and other cells that that also copies the cancer in those other cells. And then we start screening for lead compounds. And then we do stuff like X-ray crystallography and high-throughput screening and molecular modeling. And we start developing these things. And eventually, we hope to get all the way into preclinical studies and into early-phase clinical studies to see if these drugs actually are very effective. And it works. It works pretty well. We can set up crystals very quickly. These are instruments in my lab. These are crystals that were actually grown in my lab against a protein target that we thought was very important in pancreatic cancer. We put them up into a very high-powered X-ray diffractometer. We collect the diffraction patterns, and we make these beautiful images. And from those beautiful images, we'll go to a chemist and say, hey, can you actually make a drug that will fit in this? Can you make the hand that will fit in that glove or the key that will fit into that lock? And if we're lucky, we can get a structure, we can find a molecule, and we can find that that molecule goes right to the target. And if we can develop that, we will stop that molecule from working. That's in a good day. Another way that we can try to do this is through, not sure what's going on here, is that we could try to actually assemble a bunch of parts. Maybe the protein we want to target has got a square and a circle and a kind of a triangle. And maybe if we can find little pieces that can go into each one of these, we can actually kind of tether them all together. We could design the drug. We can fit the hand to the glove, if you will. And if we have two different targets that look different, so here's the square, the triangle, and the circle, where you have the square, the circle, and the triangle. If we put those together, that drug will fit here, but it will never fit down in there. And again, this has actually been a little bit successful. This is called a BRAF inhibitor, veratinib. This goes after a BRAF. It was selectively designed by putting the pieces together. And when that worked, there is actually some chance of suppressing melanoma. Skin cancer, metastatic melanoma is about the worst thing that could happen to anybody. It is a devastating disease. And so through this approach, we were able to make some drugs. So these are successes, but they're actually kind of limited. There's lots of different ways for cells to go wrong, and there's lots of different ways for cancer to manifest itself. And so what we need is a whole bunch more drugs. And if you try to just kind of do the numbers, how many drugs are out there, and how many can we possibly find? Some people estimate that we could probably get up to 10 to the 23. That's an awful lot of drugs. Okay, that's, again, a one with 23 zeros after it. Somebody even postulated we can get up to 10 to the 60th. That's, if there was one electron for each 10 to the 60th, that's probably more matter than there is in the whole universe. Probably a reasonable number is about 10 to the 33. And the person who did the study said, look, you know, if we took the best 500 supercomputers in the United States, anywhere in the world, and we can compute one, we could only compute 10 to the 14. That's a lot of this number that's still there, right? There's still, it's only 14 zeros. There's 33 zeros after that. Another way to think about that is the age of the universe is about 10 to the 17th seconds. It's a long time, but 10 to the 17th seconds. A bond vibration, a molecule that's vibrating, vibrates at about 1 femtosecond. So if we look at 1 femto, about 10 to the 14th seconds, or 10 to the 14th times in a second, if we actually put those together, we get about 10 to the 23rd femtoseconds. So if we can make a one molecule every bond vibration, we might get to the age of the universe. We can't do that. This is absolutely not going to happen. We can't cover the diversity of all possible molecules that could potentially be made. So we really need to turn to something much better. The chemical space is just too vast for us to probe. So what we need to do is actually we need to go to something far more intelligent. We actually need to go to nature. Nature has been around for a long time. We need to find sources where nature has already vetted a lot of these different kind of combinations. Let's let nature tell us what kind of works for it. So let's get back to where we started and where we found, you know, traditional Chinese herbs and other kind of medicines. We know that one of the best places has got to be the ocean. It covers 70% of the Earth's surface. There's over 1.3 billion cubic kilometers of seawater. That's a lot of volume. There's a lot of things that can be held in that kind of amount of water. Life in the ocean is 3 billion years. Life on land is 0.4. Land, the ocean, life has been 10 times, evolving 10 times longer in the ocean. It's estimated, or it was recently counted, that there's 250,000 different species in the ocean. They actually extrapolated that to 1 million different species in the ocean. And out of that, they think there's tens to hundreds of millions of different microbes in the oceans. We haven't even scratched even 100,000 microbes. So it's a very, very rich source of biodiversity and chemical diversity. And part of this is that living in the ocean is hard, right? This isn't quite on land. You can't make a tree and put a nest up on a branch and not worry about some land animal necessarily getting to it. Things can move up and down in the water column. On top of that, certain places like coral reefs, which are particularly in danger right now, these are kind of deserts. There's a reason you can see so far in a coral reef. You can see 200 feet, 400 feet in a coral reef. It's because there's nothing in there. There's no nutrients. So anytime a nutrient comes available in a coral reef, it's immediately assimilated. And each one of these corals are vying for some space. And believe it or not, they have chemical warfare going on like we wouldn't even imagine. Part of this chemical warfare that's going on is it's in water. It's freely soluble. It can go anywhere. You come and you bite a leaf on a tree, well, it's in your mouth, and it can be less concentrated because it's in your mouth. It doesn't diffuse through the air. So the chemicals that these guys are making, not only to colonize this area, they also make chemicals so they won't be eaten by other fish and everything else that needs some food. So the coral reefs themselves have devised some of the most interesting chemicals and some of the most potent and toxic chemicals that are known. And this is actually borne out by data. This is some study that was done in 1999. If you look at all the compounds that have ever been isolated from any kind of organism in the world, terrestrial plants, terrestrial animals, marine plants, marine animals, what you find is that you have a sevenfold improvement of finding something that's valuable from the ocean. This is better than anything in the Amazon rainforest. This is better than going to the New York subway and looking in the sewer and finding out whatever kind of microbes are there. You're going to do much better in the coral reefs, or actually in the ocean. And some of these are interesting. So they know some of the molecule or some of the organisms that are more likely to produce these. And if you look at them, you have these filter feeders, like the bryozoa. You could have tunicates, the chordata. You might have corals. And corals aren't just the stony corals like I'm showing here. They're also the soft corals that kind of go back and forth. They're also jellyfish. Those are also cnidaria. Those are different kinds of corals. And then you have porifera. These are sponges. One thing that almost all of these things have in common is they don't move. They're sessile. They're kind of stuck in that area. So it's really incumbent upon them to figure out how not to get eaten and how to defend their territory. And this probably likely reflects this kind of chemical diversity because they actually have to stand their ground and fight. So what can we get? I think a really good example comes from these tunicates. These tunicates are making really interesting molecules. These probably don't mean a lot to everybody here, but the diversity here is something that's just not something we whip up in a afternoon after going to Starbucks in the lab. There's certain chemistry here that chemists are still even trying to figure out, but these tunicates make it. An interesting drug that was recently isolated from a tunicate is this Yandelis. It's a very sophisticated molecule. If you showed this to any professor at any university, a synthetic organic chemist, it'd take them a while to figure out how to make this. It may be 50, 60, 70 steps to make this molecule. But they're interested in it because it's an intellectual challenge. The problem was to get this, to get 1 gram, they actually had to go and isolate 1 ton of tunicates. That's a lot of material just to get 1 gram. And to do a clinical trial, we need about 5 grams. Just to do a phase 1 clinical trial, we need a lot of this material because we need to make sure it works. And we're going to have to give it to patients, so we need about 5 grams. So this isn't very sustainable. But if we can actually get a chemist, in this case a very famous chemist from Harvard, E.J. Corey, to make these, we can actually do it a little bit quicker. We went to the ocean, we found something interesting. If it has some biological activity, chemists can come up, and it's actually, I think, fun. I don't know what kind of masochists they are, but they like to make these kind of molecules. This molecule is actually being used for soft tissue sarcomas. It's also being, clinical trials are actually being run for breast cancer, prostate, and some pediatric sarcomas. The mechanism of action, this is what we always want to know. How does this molecule work? It seems to kind of get really close up to DNA and then causes a free radical, and that breaks the DNA itself. I think they're still trying to get this a little bit more careful or carefully studied, but that's an interesting mechanism. Another molecule that's actually been discovered at City of Hope and synthesized at the City of Hope by my chairman, David Horn. There is almost none of this material available, this Grossularia. And so through a very elegant chemical step, he was able to do one chemical step and he was able to make this molecule. This molecule itself seems to have some very good activity against different solid tumor lines. One of the hardest cancers for us to work on are the solid tumors. Pancreatic cancer, ovarian cancer, colorectal cancers. These are real killers. So we can make these molecules. This was also isolated from a tunicate. And you can see how successful he was. This is these tunicates. They don't always come in blue. Sometimes they're clear, sometimes they're orange. In this case, this was the red molecule. Dave took a very simple, Dr. Horn took a very simple compound, did two steps in the same pot, was able to make this. And you can see when he isolated it, it was this bright, bright red. And here you see grams of it. You know, it kind of looks like the same color of the tunicate that he's got in it. And so these are some of the assays that we would do to go find out, is this actually active? And so it has a pretty good IC50. I'm sorry, this is micromolar. So the IC50 is around 2 micromolar. That's a good start for making a drug. It's not perfect. We'd like it to be even better. But it also has nice properties where it's actually turning off key enzymes that we know drive cancer. Okay? So here's another very nice example from something from the ocean that we were able to isolate. Because it had some chemical properties that we liked, we were able to synthesize, and we're able to take this into clinical, at least in preclinical trials right now. Here's another kind of fun one. This is actually a pain medicine. I don't think it's going to twist around. I'm sorry. I had this all spinning around for you. This cone snail secretes this very, very toxic poison. It goes in and it renders the nerves incomplete, and the prey just generally kind of dies. And then it goes and it just eats the whole thing up. Recently they found that this molecule, which we're calling Prialt, is 1,000 times more potent than morphine. 1,000 times more potent. It's not easily distributed. You actually have to put it right into the spine to use it. But when morphine isn't working, and in extreme cases where people have pain, this is a miracle drug. And it was isolated from a marine organism. It's essentially, it's a calcium channel blocker, and calcium channels are part of the pain reception that we get. All right. Some other things that we also get. This is actually isolated just off the California coast. This is from a bryozoan. It's called a bryostatin. It's a very complicated molecule. Whenever you see these kind of square or these lines that kind of come out, that means there's stereochemistry. That means the molecule has handedness. And when you have a lot of handedness in a small molecule, it means it's going to be really difficult to synthesize. But now these are actually being synthesized. In phase 1 and phase 2 clinical trials are being developed. This molecule is a microtubule inhibitor, and what it does is it stops cells from proliferating too rapidly. And even very recently, this small molecule here was isolated in some cyanobacteria just off of, I believe this was Santa Cruz. Is this Belize or is this I think it's Belize. There's another, I'm sorry, I'm blanking here. Anyway, this molecule looks very close to this one compound called virostatin. Virostatin is now being used for chronic T-cell lymphoma. This molecule may actually have better potency. Sometimes when we find a molecule, we get it in and we try to help people as fast as we can, but the first molecule is not always the best in class. Sometimes other leads come in and they're actually better and more efficacious. And so that's why you see some of the serotonin inhibitors progress. You start off with Prozac and now we're to Zoloft and we're to Cymbalta and stuff. So still, in 19, you know, just last year, this molecule was discovered, and it's something that we're going to probably be taking on to the clinic. City Hope isn't, but some other groups are. So there's non-trivial barriers. There's a reason why we don't go to the marine environment all the time. These molecules are ridiculously complicated. They have really good efficacy, This was just recently approved by the FDA for metastatic breast cancer. This is the kind of breast cancer that really tears people's lives apart. The problem is when they first found this molecule, they only got 300 milligrams, 0.3 grams from over 1 ton of that sponge. All right? So we can't just go in and start taking everything from the ocean and keep harvesting it, because these sponges, as Dr. Schubel will tell you, and any one of the people here in husbandry will tell you, are very difficult to grow. However, if we can get enough of this material, and we can take all the force of City of Hope and all the power that we have to study these really quickly, if we find one, we might be able just to isolate the one chemical, and then we can get chemists to actually solve it, just as Dave Horn did for the Grossularin. This is just another example I want to give you. We're not done. We're nowhere close to done. This was published just this year from this sponge here, and look at all these different chemicals that popped out of them. I can promise you this molecule here will probably never be synthesized by a chemist. This is just way, way, way too hard. They'd probably get bored. So remember, I was telling you that this is very complicated. We're looking for these small molecules. These small molecules target certain proteins that cause cancer. But it's complicated. It's complicated because these same processes that are happening in healthy cells could be happening in cancer cells and could also be happening in the human body. And recently, people have turned to the immune system, and this is something that's ongoing at the City of Hope. The immune system, the antibodies that are inside your body, are exquisitely specific for certain kinds of diseases. You get a viral infection or you get a bacteria and you get sick. The immune system comes in and it starts making antibodies left and right, and those antibodies only recognize something on that virus or something on that bacteria. And once they get developed, they always go to that bacteria, and then this is the business, and it says, okay, immune system, come in and take it. So what we would like to be able to do is take the remarkable specificity of these antibodies and marry these with a drug. And interestingly, this small molecule here, it's called eriostatin or dolostatin, was isolated from this sea hare. This was isolated about 15 years ago. This molecule was so potent that we couldn't actually give it to humans. Remember, there's all those processes going on all at the same time in all those cells, cancer and healthy cells. So if you gave this systemically, it would kill people. But if we actually hooked this molecule up onto this antibody, the antibody kind of keeps it in the bloodstream. This part goes and hones to the cancer cell. Maybe we can actually deliver that straight to the cancer cell. And so we can take a potent toxin and actually deliver it and avoid all those other adverse side effects. And sure enough, this just recently happened. Just last year, a drug called T-DM1 was approved. And what they've taken was this eriostatin and hooked it up onto this antibody. This antibody went to breast cancer cells, HER2-positive metastatic breast cancers, and were able to get inside the cells and just release that potent drug inside there. Okay. Doing this is challenging, and this is something that my lab focuses on a lot. We're trying to develop antibodies, and we're trying to weaponize them, if you will. But when we weaponize them, there's inherent problems. We just can't add those drugs anywhere willy-nilly, and they just don't work. And it's very difficult to actually re-engineer all these molecules. We actually needed to come up with something that was a little bit easier solution. And in my lab, doing X-ray crystallography, we actually solved a crystal structure of a little part of this arm on this antibody here. And we actually discovered something that nobody's ever seen before. We found a small molecule that bound right inside this little hole inside of there. And what we found is that small molecule was distinct from where the business end of the antibody is, and it was different than some other proteins, but it was completely unique to this. And what we began to realize is that this site itself can be used as a hitch, okay? We can make the antibody, and then we could add any kind of drug that we want onto this green molecule, and we can have a hitch, all right? So we make the antibody, we mix it, and we allow the antibody to go to the disease itself. And what we'd really like to do is we want to add a lot of things onto these antibodies. But what we think would be very fantastic and something that we can actually do with the Aquarium of the Pacific is we can make a lot of these metatopes with different drugs that are from the ocean, and we can actually get to a point of personalized medicine. We can actually start making antibodies that are common for breast cancer, common for colorectal, common for neuro-gliomas. And we'll have a whole toolbox of different small molecules that are welded onto this metatope site, and we can start delivering those to the tumor, and we should be much more effective at actually curing cancer. So I've talked an awful lot about cancer. I'm at the City of Hope. This is all we do, and this is all we think about. We need more drugs, and we need to do a better job, because too many of us, our loved ones, parents, and friends, will end up with cancer. But there's many other reasons to be conserving the ocean, too. And one of them is this. My son is actually in the audience here. One time we were in New Jersey, and one of these horseshoe crabs came up to the beach and scared the living daylights out of him. They're kind of ugly creatures, really. I mean, you go up, they're kind of, they look prehistoric, and you don't really like to see these. The thing is that these actually solve a critical problem in developing any medicine. When we make medicines, sometimes we use bacteria to make them. Sometimes they're in solution, and we get something called an endotoxin. An endotoxin is something called a lipopolysaccharide. And these lipopolysaccharides, these LPSs, when they're put into the body, causes your immune system to really flare up enormously. And when it flares up, all of a sudden your body goes into essentially toxic shock, and sepsis happens, and people are known to die just because you put in an innocuous molecule, but a molecule that turns on the immune system too far. And that immune system goes on and kills people. So this LPS binds to the molecule. We know what this looks like. I don't know if I'm going to be able to get the video up on this. I'm sorry. So it binds to this molecule called toll-like receptor, activates this immune response, drives inflammatory response, leading to septic shock. So anytime anybody makes any molecule that's going to be injected into you, we actually have to go and look to see if that LPS, that endotoxin, is existing. And we need to know for stuff like what we use even at City of Hope, Avastin, Rituxan, Enbrel, and Humulin. These are all molecules that some people might have seen on TV. We need to make sure there's no endotoxins in those molecules, or else we'll kill the patient. Alternatively, if you're going to get a stent or you're going to have some medical device, you're going to get something into your eye, you're going to have in vitro fertilization, again, you have to test for endotoxins. You can't do this, the FDA will shut you down. The other problem about endotoxins, they're hard to get rid of. When they're in the solution, it's not like you can just heat them up and kill them. They stay around. So this comes back to the horseshoe crab. The horseshoe crabs actually make this blue blood. They don't have hemoglobin. They have a different kind of blood, and it's blue. And the blood cells inside of these horseshoe crabs actually have a series of enzymes. And when these series of enzymes actually see an endotoxin, it goes through a cascade, and it all of a sudden coagulates massively, right? And if it coagulates massively, we know that there's an endotoxin in present, and that means we can't use that drug anymore. This has saved numerous lives. The way that they used to do this is they would inject a rabbit. Rabbits aren't nearly as sensitive to endotoxins as this is here. And so the horseshoe crab, as ugly as it was and scared my son and kind of freaks me out sometimes, actually has a blood product that we can't even reproduce in the lab. But if we can get some of their blood, and I've been told that this is, the mortality rate's only 3%, or most crabs live through this bloodletting. They can go back and they can be saved. You can get a product that actually makes a medical difference. This isn't making a drug, it's just making sure that the drugs and the devices that we use can actually be used. Other things that actually have come from the ocean that you probably don't know have changed the course of everything we do in medicine, even in forensics. And these are molecules like polymerases. You can go down to these deep thermal vents and there's life down there. And these organisms are living at maybe 400 degrees with a ton of pressure, and the proteins they make are extremely, extremely stable. But if we can isolate these polymerases, we can actually use those to propagate DNA signals. This was necessary for us to do the whole genome. This is also necessary for us if you go to a forensic site and you find a little piece of DNA from somebody, we can take that DNA, and if we use the polymerase from a deep vent organism, and we literally call this deep vent polymerase, we use it every day in my lab. If you have that polymerase and you find that little sample of blood that contains a minute amount of DNA, we can actually use this to amplify the signal, and we can find out who was actually at the scene. This also allows us to do all this new biotechnology. You think about all these new oils that are being made from algae. These were done through a lot of molecular biology, and it was really done with this deep vent polymerase that was taken from the bottom of the ocean. And one that we always like, and I get teased by my colleague because for some reason scientists like to think about things that glow, is from the jellyfish was a protein called GFP, green fluorescent protein. And you probably have seen this under certain blue lights that these different corals come up with different kind of colors. It turned out that this was remarkably useful for us. This is a protein. We know what the gene is that makes this protein. And we could actually put that gene onto things that we want to study. We want to find out what that molecule is doing in that particular cell. So we'll actually fuse the gene sequence onto that molecule. And because of that, there was a Nobel Prize that was just awarded in 2008 for the discovery of GFP and the application of GFP. And we use it also in my lab. And this is just one example of some of the experiments we do. But what we were really concerned about is how does the protein outside the cell or out in the cytoplasm actually get into the nucleus? And we made different kind of point mutations, and we were able to show a certain point mutation in this particular protein that causes cancer. If that was made, then it no longer actually went inside the cell, and that changed the way that we thought about how to drug this particular example. The other thing is it's not just GFP. If you look, and I'm sure if you go to the marine exhibits, particularly the corals, I think upstairs, you'll find some are green, some are orange, some are blue, some are pink. All of these are proteins. These are different fluorescent proteins. And we could put those different fluorescent proteins behind different genes. And if we do this right, we can actually start doing some of the most intricate mapping of anything we want. This particularly happens to be a brain. And we can see all the different kinds of neurons, and we can actually tell you which kind of neurons those are, and we can tell you what the organization of those neurons are, and we can begin to tell you how memory is actually formed, because we can color those different genes that are involved. And one more time, this has happened again. Another Nobel Prize this year. This year, for super-resolution microscopy. And super-resolution microscopy was made possible because of GFP proteins. And what it does is, with this new technique, is the old style of microscopy, this is what we would see, okay? Not a whole lot of information here. We see some nice orange blobs. If we go down to super resolution, we begin to start seeing all the different organization of how proteins are inside the cell. And sometimes this tells us things that we couldn't possibly know. We're using a lot of this with our antibody technology. And it's telling us new ways of making better drugs and targeting more specifically. This is another example over here. This is what this would look like in normal microscopy. And with the advent of super-resolution microscopy, we can actually start seeing all those dots. And we can see certain areas where there's more green and less red. And that tells us about the organization of these certain proteins. And if we know that organization, that's going to tell us the mechanism. If we know the mechanism, that's going to allow us to target better, and it's going to give us information we couldn't possibly have. So with that, I just want to conclude. The future is extraordinarily bright. We have an awful lot of work to do in curing cancer. We desperately need more molecules. We can't synthesize them. We can't sit in our lab with a bucket of Starbucks and all the chemicals in the world and make all of these. It's not even physically possible to make all of these. So we can get a lot of this from the oceans. And I believe that there's new methods of culturing coral. We can use coral, for instance, as fertilizer to start putting different bacterias and seeing what different combinations of bacterias will give rise to what new chemicals and isolate those chemicals. The last 10 years have seen some of the most extraordinary advances in molecular biology and DNA sequencing. We solved the human genome. We know what all the proteins are supposed to be. We can do the same kind of things to marine organisms. We also have advanced structural and chemical methods. What we can do today was unfathomable 10 years ago. I'm sure what we'll do 10 years from now is going to be unfathomable to us today. And so in the end, we're at the aquarium for a really important reason. Human health, the ability to fight cancer, the ability to fight other diseases is going to require a lot of diversity. The only way that we're going to maintain the diversity is by conserving the oceans, by making sure that we don't wipe out the very things that we love to look at. And from these things, we are going to find different drugs that have different mechanisms that are going to be more specific, that are going to get us away from the complicated stuff that we have. We're going to be able to take these and put them onto antibodies and be more specific. We're really going to get to the point where we're going to be able to make personalized medicine. And so with that, I see the City of Hope and I see the Aquarium of the Pacific intimately connected, similar missions. We want to have health. We want to have health of the oceans. We need to take care of our patients. We have research. We need to understand how corals work. We need to understand why there's more jellyfish or less jellyfish and how that affects other fish in the area. And we need a lot more research at the City of Hope where we're finding if we can get these drugs, how we can develop those drugs so that we can get them over into our patients. And so with that, I thank you for your attention.